Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. Politicians, scientists, specialists, and even philosophers frequently claim to be right. They profess to have an understanding of how things ultimately are, yet at the same time know this can't plausibly be the case. So should we give up the idea that it is possible to be definitively right? Or is that possibility essential to progress and culture? Joining us to debate the idea of certainty, our author of Freedom in the Age of Alternative Facts, Santiago Zabala, pragmatist epistemologist Corny Besson, an expert of Indian thought, Chakravarti Ramprasad. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit our website, iai.tv, for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers. I'll now hand you over to our host for this debate, Rana Mitter.
Hello. In the history of humankind, there's no theory that's been shown to be definitive. No claim that cannot be disputed, nor can we imagine a time when such a dispute will come to an end. So, should we give up the very idea that it's possible to be definitively right? Would this usher in a new age of compromise? Or is the possibility of being right essential to progress and culture, without which we risk violence and conflict? Big issues, particularly for a bright, and I must say sunny morning, at least here in the UK, where I'm speaking to you from. Let me introduce you to our fantastically expert panel who are going to debate these issues. First of all, we have Santiago Zabala, who is a CREA research professor of philosophy at the Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona in Spain. He's the author of Being at Large, Freedom in the Age of Alternative Facts, and he's made important contributions to the issues of environmental destruction, social inequality, and the dangers of right-wing populism. And then we have Corinne Besson. She is a leading philosopher in the areas of epistemology, the philosophy of logic, and the philosophy of language, and she's based at the University of Sussex in the UK. Her most recent work aims to use philosophical realism and apply it to contemporary debates, and she's currently writing a book for Oxford University Press titled Logic, Reasoning, and the Tortoise. And Chakravarti Ramprasad is one of the world's leading philosophers in the field of comparative philosophy. He's helped to make clear the similarities and disparities between Western philosophy and Eastern religion. So three immensely expert speakers today, and I'm going to ask each of them to give us 3 minutes on a tough, quite starkly phrased question, and then we'll move into what I'm sure is going to be a very lively debate, after which we'll turn to you, our audience around the world, to help enrich that debate. So our first question is it possible to be definitively right? And to give us a take on that question, I'm delighted to call on Santiago Zabala. Santiago, over to you.
Thank you very much. Well, is it possible to be definitely right? No, I don't think it is. And a good theory, a good philosophy would be one that acknowledges that fact. In other words, that leaves it flexible enough or some... It's post-metaphysical enough in order to allow the change to happen. In other words, if we understand that knowledge is not simply an accumulation, In other words, philosophy is not simply an accumulation of knowledge, but rather, as Richard Rorty explained very well, and actually before him, Thomas Kuhn, it has more to do with edification. In other words, it is not that we have more correct theories, we just have better theories that change through the course of history. So I think even this same theory, which is basically what pragmatics and hermeneutic philosophy deal with, it does not demand, it does not pretend to be the ultimate right position. On the contrary, it is just it's just a form to consider your own theory as part of a very long conversation, which again, it is not aimed toward truth, but rather towards an accumulation an accumulation of different interpretation of different views. And basically, it's an idea to overcome once for all the God's eyed view.
Santiago, thank you very much indeed for a statement both made with conciseness and with great clarity. Is it possible to be definitely right? Santiago says no. Corinne Besson, do you agree?
Corinne Besson says yes. Thank you for having me on this debate. I'm very happy to be here. So I think, you know, I want to say yes, but I think it depends a little bit on how we take the question. So, you know, one question is, you know, can we all agree about something? Can we, you know, can we all converge on a claim or a theory? And the answer to that is probably no, at least I can't see it coming. But, you know, you can take the question as concerning the question whether, in fact, bracketing agreement or disagreement, it is possible for a claim or a theory to be right. And I think it's definitely possible for a claim or a theory to be right, even in light of possible disagreement. For instance, you know, either there is man-made climate change or there isn't. If I say there isn't and you say there is, one of us is wrong and one of us is right. You know, either the universe is expanding or it's not expanding. You know, if you think it's expanding and I think it's not expanding, then one of us is right and the other is wrong. So, and you know, and so forth for many other kind of substantive claims like that. So I think you can definitely be right about these things. Now, maybe it is hard for you to know that you're right about these things, or maybe it's hard to arrive at a consensus that you're right, but because it's hard for you to, you know, establish that you're right. That's another question, but that doesn't mean that you can't in fact be right, even if you think that you're right, or you can't convince your opponent that you're right. Now, consensus or reaching an agreement, you know, is a difficult matter. Even for fairly established theories or views, such as man-made climate change, there will be always someone who disagrees. And obviously, if it's the, you know, person at the bus stop who disagrees with you, maybe you can say, well, I don't care. But if it's a peer or an expert, then, you know, you do have to care. So disagreement is difficult. You know, we disagree, you know, because we come at questions from different perspectives or with different skills or outlooks or backgrounds. But I think we also disagree, and that's really a feature, especially of, you know, philosophical thinking, because it's very often very difficult to show that something is right. So you might be right, but, you know, it's hard to establish beyond that you are right about something. And whenever there is room, you know, for doubt, there is room for disagreement. But I don't think that disagreement should make us doubt that there is indeed the possibility of being right. And perhaps we're working with too high thresholds of evidence or proof when we demand that, you know, we show that we are definitely right. Maybe we should aim for something less ambitious than the sort of absolute certainty.
Thanks very much indeed, Corinne. And I think I agree with you about disagreement, but I don't know if that's helpful or not in this context. Before we get back to those reasoned agreements and disagreements in our debate, let me turn to Ram. Ram, the key question here again is it possible to be definitively right?
Okay, so I do think that Corinne has raised some questions about issues of evidence and the thresholds for evidence, as well as what constitutes agreement or consensus. And I'm sure that we'll be talking more about that in this panel. To go back to the original question about truth, I've often felt that perhaps from a particular Indian perspective of the philosophical traditions of the religion of Jainism, that we too easily depend upon whichever side we are on, are there truths that we can find and are there not? We too easily depend upon, I think, two types of ideas about the nature of truth. And I'll label them without any relationship to how others have used these words, foundational and monotonic. What I mean by foundational views of truth is that you start with a set of statements that you think are as true as anybody is going to be able to agree on. So a molecule of water, you might say, really requires two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen, and no amount of deconstruction or interpretation can get around that. So if you're going to have that kind of set of truths, then you build, you scaffold other types of truths in relation to the standards required for this kind of truth. So it becomes foundational. Another kind that I'm just off the top of my head calling monotonic is not necessarily to think about the metaphysical foundations of what constitutes the most sort of inescapable kinds of truth, but rather to say that if we do have some kind of a coherence of theory of truth, then that same kind of set of requirements as to how you go about it, how you reason to it, how you arrive at something, how you demonstrate it, and what the plausible rhetorics around it are the same in different kinds of fields. In contrast, the Jains had, with reference to the foundational approach, something that roughly is called many-sidedness. So they had a very difficult and challenging notion that perhaps reality itself is irreducibly multiple, that there are some kinds of ways in which there could be a way of arriving at types of truths which are incompatible with each other. I'm not necessarily defending it, but that is the kind of route down which they went. To me, the more interesting one is their response to this notion of monotonicity, you might say. And that roughly translates as a theory of conditionals. So they basically said that it's very difficult to migrate from one contextual kind of area in which you go about trying to find the truth and agree on what the means of arriving at it are, and another. It all depends upon the conditionals within which you wrap those kinds of agreements. So if you see it in that way, it's not so much that you are saying that truths are constructed or that it is relative or it's always theory dependent, nor are you saying that we have to start with a commitment to certain kinds of fundamental truths and ways of arriving at them, and everything else is about whether we are able to convince people or not, whether we have sufficient evidence for it or not, and so forth. Rather, we must be able to return to each particular context and find perhaps that there are some which are irreducibly sort of incompatible, and we need to turn the or recontextualize our framing.
Thank you very much indeed for a whole range of very stimulating thoughts there, in fact, from all three of our speakers. What I'd like to do is to move into a debate where I hope that we can throw some of these ideas up against each other. If we could stick with this idea of what it means for a theory to be right, and you've given us, you know, a range of ways of thinking about this just now, is there something that's very kind of culturally grounded in terms of the idea of rightness in the first place? You mentioned briefly the idea of Jainism and religions, and I have to say the idea of, you know, multipolarity or multi-layeredness strikes me in some ways like some of the theories of the universe, in which actually we don't have one reality but multiverses that operate at the same time depending which, you know, reality you're in. So is that sense of multiplicity helpful in terms of moving us away from the idea that there is one sort of objective reality, or is that not the purpose of that way of thinking?
Well, I think the Jains themselves thought that they were paradoxically giving a view of reality as multiple. So they wanted to be able to, they were addressing this very disputatious and highly pluralistic context of classical India, where because there wasn't one text that people could agree on, there wasn't sort of one set of doctrines that people were required to interpret. They were trying to find how could you have a framework in which you are epistemically accessible to the other person. How is it that we don't seem to be able to agree century after century upon anything? How are you going to reconcile these features? So their view was to say, well, perhaps it's because the world, this world in which we live, can contain incompatible truths. Now, I think that works perhaps better as a kind of justification for the nature of human psychology, that we're simultaneously committed to the search for truth and at the same time baffled by the fact that we don't seem to be able to agree on too many things. Whether that then can become a program for people to be able to engage with each other, I think that's going to require certain other kinds of intellectual virtues, which are not really about the truth, but the nature of our engagement with each other. And I rather suspect that some of our, both Santiago and Corinne, might want to say more about the way in which the conditions of agreement have a bearing on what we accept to be the problem about truth.
Okay, thanks very much. And just to say one thing, Raman, I'm not going to come back to you on this because I want to bring the others in, but just to say in terms of the definition of working today, you very neatly, if I may say, elided us from the question of whether things are right, which is what the debate's about, to whether they're true. Now, obviously, there can be a confluence between the two, but of course, there is at the very least a sort of moral freight on rightness, potentially, that I think we do need to tease apart a bit. But I'm going to turn, if I may, back to Santiago to do that, because if we look at this question of whether you can definitively say whether something is right rather than whether it's true, the two are not incompatible, but it's not actually quite the same question, is it?
Yes, you're absolutely right. I think it's
I'm right, but I may be true as well.
Yeah, you're right, you're true, but only among each other. In other words, the question here is that truth is really a result of our social agreement we decide upon ourselves. Because if we look, for example, at climate change, which is a very good example, Bruno Latour, who is a very important philosopher of science, pointed out in his last book that, well, facts alone, truth alone, right alone, does not work. It's not sustained. That's a problem with fake news and all that. So truth alone, we're not gonna do anything with that. He explains in the book that it's called down to earth in English, that, well, you need institutions, you need established newspapers, you need academics, you need a whole range of, you need a whole establishment in some way, although we shouldn't use the word perhaps establishment, in order to sustain truth being right or facts. So I think it's very important to take into consideration that, well, truth in some way, it's basically what our, you know, what our contemporaries let us get away with in some way. So basically what we all agree upon in some way. This is why I think that it's important to point, just one more thing, it's important to point out that fundamental values are not the result of a historical development toward truth, but rather an agreement among social communities. This explains why the history of science is not a perfect unilinear history. And by the way, why are we hermeneutic philosophers going against this? Why are we saying this thing? Well, a lot of people think, well, it's because of some theoretical reasons, some knowledge we achieved. No, on the contrary, it's more for an ethical justification. In other words, if we look, for example, someone who explained this very well is Bauman. Zygmunt Bauman pointed out very clearly that the problem with this huge rational, Western rational modernist dream of embracing this absolute view and basically of Western civilization, the problem with this view is that genocide follows, colonialism follows. You end up by imposing in some way, okay, a value that perhaps a lot of people do not want to have. Now, it's very important, and this is really my last point, is that, well, there are different levels of truth too. If I tell you right now that there is a library behind me, of course, we all agree that there is a library behind me. But that, from a theoretical, even an ontological point of view, it's very poor. I mean, it's not a great statement. If I tell you that it's a beautiful library, well, you might disagree. And if I tell you what books I have, you might totally disagree. So here it's a question that we have to really take into consideration that there is no neutral language that we can all use. There are several languages upon which we should have what I prefer to call a conversation rather than a dialogue, right? A dialogue is something that Plato did, ending up by taking the slave from the cave. A conversation is something more weak that you don't really know where it's going to end.
Thanks very much indeed, Santiago. And don't worry, we will be coming back to you. But Corinne, I think we seem to be moving in a direction where we're looking at what's true and making that perhaps a subset of what's right. Do you have yourself a set of, I mean, to use a dangerous word these days, objective standards about how we can actually define what is true? Is that something we can meaningfully say? Can you meaningfully say it?
Yeah, I think surprisingly, I think it is something we can meaningfully say. And I think, you know, both Santiago and Sacravati are going to agree, you know, to be for claim or theory to be true, then it's just going to be something about, you know, correctly describing what it's aiming to describe or what it's talking about. Obviously, you know, I take your point about being true and being right, and there is a one way to understand being right as being correct, and that sort of connects up with true, and that there is one way of being right which is more has to do with other kinds of norms and perhaps, you know, has an ethical dimension which is different. I took it that the debate was about the first notion. I'd like to react to one thing Santiago said and also one thing that Sacravati said, if that's okay. So I do agree with Santiago that truth, you know, if you think of a theory like anthropogenic climate change, you know, it's a very complex thing, a theory, and truth is not everything. I agree with him that truth is not everything. I mean, there are issues to do with, you know, establishing the truth or arguing for the truth, having the right institutions that enable you to do that, and then et cetera, et cetera. But true, I mean, sometimes, you know, I mean, we should slide between saying truth is not everything and truth is not, does not matter, or is not the aim of the theory or something like that. I mean, it might be the case that, you know, truth is not everything, but that doesn't mean that it's kind of nothing, or that, you know, truth is not actually the key thing that is operating in us looking for theories. So I think I'd like to hear more about that. I was interested by what Sacravati said about incompatible truth and the possibility of there being, you know, often we presuppose that there is just one truth out there and, you know, it's a matter of finding it and then, you know, perhaps there aren't, you know, there are several truths and they, you know, they can't all be true. I think I would be reluctant to sort of think of that as something that has to be, you know, taken to hold across the board. I think, you know, you might, you know, he was interested in talking of religious theories or religious views. That's one thing. You know, maybe science is another thing. So I think we can, you know, perhaps agree that there are areas where the idea of a unique truth is, you know, has to be revisited or perhaps massaged in some way. But we shouldn't think that because that's the case in all areas, and especially in areas where we might have better claims to think that is just, you know, a unique way the world is, then we should give up on there being a unique type of truth. But it's true that, you know, there might be contexts in which that's different.
Yeah, Ram, come on in.
If I may come in on that. So yes, that's exactly what I mean when I said that, you know, we have to move away from a monotonic notion of truth. That is to say that perhaps using, for example, Stephen Jay Gould's idea of, you know, magisteria, what we might
end up... Can you just explain that idea briefly, Ram? Sure. People may not know what it is.
Yes, of course. I was just coming to that. Yeah. So the idea that Stephen Jay Gould was trying to say, how is it that you could have religious lives which are coherent and grounded and driven by particular claims about knowledge, which have no bearing on, or in the case of creationism, perhaps come up against the theories of evolution. And he was interested also in the fact that many religious traditions in the world had no problems with evolution. And yet, of course, they were not concerned with finding out about, you know, dinosaurs and the Vedas. So how does that happen? He said, well, there are magisteria, by which he meant there are authoritative domains of discourse in which the truth is relative to the purposes of why that discourse has evolved and the direction towards which that discourse drives. So it's not so much that they are clashing with each other as that they have different purposes, and therefore it's possible to think about, say, liberation from the suffering of life if you're a Buddhist, while also saying we know pretty much, you know, why the dinosaurs were wiped out at the end of the Cretaceous. These are things that You might say, well, was the Buddha talking about the suffering of the dinosaurs at that point, if all life is suffering? For him, that would become a meaningless kind of question to ask. So you work within these different domains, and what constitutes the truth in those domains would be consistent and relevant with the purposes of that debate. I think our problem comes when we do not have that kind of clash. I suppose with climate change, one would say that, but also with, I think, larger theories of the human good, what do we aim for if there are things where you're actually claiming that you are on the same turf, then we start having the question whether there are irreducible incompatibles, or whether it is simply the case that one is right and the other is wrong, even though we have no explanation whatsoever apart from a persistent evolutionary capacity for human beings to perhaps live with falsehoods, to say, why is it, or explain why is it that if there is such clarity about a commitment to there being a type of truth, we seem to find it so damn difficult to arrive at them.
Well, first, Ram, I suppose that Wittgenstein might have said that if a dinosaur could speak, would we understand what it had to say to us? But second, that ethical dimension is exactly where I'd like us to take the debate next. And I'm going to interject at this point, if I may, a quote from a man who may have known his philosophy, but was not, I think, known for his compromise with his own idea of truth. And yet in this particular statement, he did offer some. It was Oliver Cromwell, the well-known parliamentarian, and I have to say, not a man very popular in Ireland, amongst other places, but certainly with his own views of the world. And he once said to his opponent, "I beseech thee in the bowels of Christ to think that you may be mistaken." In other words, that sometimes accepting the impossibility of being right might lead to a new age of compromise and understanding. And we're going to spend a little time, I think, now delving more into that ethical side, which we touched on, but I think could come a little further. Because one of the things that's very notable about the present moment is that simultaneously, we seem to be living in a world of fake news, alternative facts, and all these phrases where reality seems to be very, very difficult to define. And yet very large numbers of people in the public square seem absolutely convinced, not only that they're right in a moral sense, but what they say is objectively true and cannot be disputed. And Santiago, you have written a book which deals with the age of fake news, alternative facts, and related issues. Could I turn to you on this and ask, is there a sense in which if we do accept one of your premises that it's impossible to be right in an objective sense, we might reach an age not of confrontation, but of compromise? Is that a realistic possibility?
I think we will reach compromise if we all agree on the historical contingencies of our interpretation, statement, description, etc. I think that's one of the first important... let me just say something, because the idea that, well, Santiago, or by that, Dewey and Rorty and Levinas, and a lot of this, there is a very long tradition of philosophers who discarded truth or think that there are more important things than truth. In other words, that, like Rorty used to say, if you take care of freedom, truth will take care of itself, and the same works for ethics and so forth. But the idea is that I like to always make this example with the whistleblowers, Snowden, Assange, and Willy, and so many other whistleblowers that have shown us the truth, right? The actual truth with documents, and nothing had changed. So the power of that objectivity there, again, it has a lot to do with what happens with our communication, what happens with our society, what sort of discourse we actually have now. This is why the idea of alternative facts, we have to remember we always had alternative facts. This is not something new. We always had alternative facts. And now, of course, we have a very big crisis due to, of course, social media and internet and everything involved in that basically our traditional vectors of legitimation, from great newspapers to university to experts, etc., has in some way lost any authority it had. The question is, how do we regain that authority? This is a very important issue, I think. Because all for you, or maybe some of our listeners are thinking, oh God, another postmodern philosopher. But what does postmodern mean? Because a lot of people, unfortunately, now recently, like it often happens, they forget what postmodernity really means. And I have here the definition because I come prepared this morning. But
is so this the only true objective definition of postmodernism, Santiago? There are no alternative versions.
Well, let me recall it's crucial to recall the so-called chaos. Okay, so I bring chaos. The so-called chaos brought about by devoiding meta-narrative to post-modernity, it did not aim, okay, did not aim to create a new order, but to avoid the external imposition of an order. So the idea of postmodern philosophy is to make sure that no big order, like a dictatorship, okay, or a unique medium comes on you, that you recognize the contingency and also the democratic plurality of the different nationalities.
Santiago, come on. A democracy is also a form of order as well. By defining order as dictatorship, you're setting your own terms. Isn't exactly where the center of the debate is? You're putting forward your idea of what you think is the true and right definition through a postmodern lens.
Let's put it this way. So according to you, instead, we should basically be left at the, leave all the experts in economy, for example, dictate how the economy should work. So basically do what the European Union tell us to do. And I think that some countries don't like that. So
you now sound like the British politician Michael Gove, Santiago, which was not a sentence I thought I would ever say to a Spanish philosopher.
Anyway, to sum up what I wanted to say, it's basically, you mentioned a moral philosopher at the beginning, and I think it's a good idea here to quote Levinas. Levinas points out that ethics, right? You mentioned ethics at the beginning. So ethics arises only by listening and responding to the request for help that the other addresses to me, not from any rational awareness of what is right and wrong.
Thanks very much indeed, Santiago. I will get on the internet in a moment and order you a special I Love Brexit t-shirt, which you can wear for the next debate. But meanwhile, I will turn to Corinne and ask, you know, the center of what Santiago is actually arguing very persuasively, I think, is the idea that we can become caught up in an idea of a constructed rightness and objectivity to do with a notion of expertise, whether it's the economics of the European Union, which Spain, of course, has very good reason because of the Eurozone not to be so keen on, or indeed whether it's the way in which climate change is used in the minds of some to make particular sorts of policy prescriptions, which in the end are political decisions, not purely objective decisions. You know, don't you think that that is a sign that we need to be cautious about using these terms?
Cautious about using the term being right?
Yeah, about this idea of rightness and objectivity.
Oh yeah, I mean, honestly, you know, it is immensely, you know, it's. I mean, just, you know, listening to the three of us, you know, we already have come up with, you know, extremely diverse answers, and we agree that, you know, having a good theory of what it would mean for anything to be right is going to be incredibly complex, and also the problem that once, you know, certain views have validated to be right.
Let me sharpen the question, if I may, in that case. You're right to pick up on that. What I understood Santiago to be saying, I can come back to him in a second to see if I'm representing him correctly, but by putting forward a postmodern position, essentially, one is breaking apart the idea at some level of any of the grand narratives, and one can argue that a sort of idea of objective reality is part of that, is useful at all. You are not taking that position, I think.
No, I'm not taking that position. And I think, you know, actually that position is not stable, okay? So, and deeply, fundamentally problematic. So, you know, you tell me, look, I've just come to terms with the view that it's impossible to be right about anything. And, you know, I'm making your point there, you know, the point you just made to Santiago. Well, you know, are you right about this? Well, you know, you better not say yes, because then that defeats the point you've just made. And you better not say no, because then you would admit to being wrong. So these claims that, you know, you can't be right about anything whatsoever, they're just not completely coherent, you know. And I don't think, you know, we can, you know, without contradicting ourselves, really hold on to this. You know, there are areas where we might give up the possibility of being right, but, you know, to operate rationally, we have to operate with the idea that we can be right about some things. And also the idea that somehow there would be a kind of value or moral or otherwise to abandoning this ambition, you know, for truth and I, you know, agree that, you know, it's impossible to be right about anything. I mean, you know, I don't see that it would increase consensus or increase agreement or, you know, I mean, in, there is no fact of the matter about, you know, an issue. You and I are not going to agree more over that issue. We're just going to stick to our guns, you know, we're just going to become even more radical about obvious. I don't see why that would be conducive to more agreement.
Okay, could I bring Santiago straight back in first? I know he wants to come right back on this and I'll come to Ram. Santiago.
Very quickly, I actually want to agree with Corinne, because the idea of hermeneutics in general is that, for example, let's take something from the past. Let's take the genocide in Rwanda, okay? There's no doubt about it. I know a lot about it because my dad worked in the United Nations. Anyway, it's a fact, it happened. But as a hermeneutic philosopher, in particular in this age of alternative facts and everything going on through social media, it's my interest that we have, let's imagine a history of what happened come out every year from a good university press. I want to sustain that fact as much as possible in order to make it clear that we are, that it's true and that it's right and that people continue to know that. That's why, and this, and right, I'm done right after this, Gadamer, Hans-Georg Gadamer, German philosopher, he insisted very much on this notion that what makes, and this works also for historical example I just made, but what makes a classic like Shakespeare or Breaking Bad a good series? Well, what makes a classic, it's the consequences it has. The fact that we continue to listen to it, we continue to interpret it, basically, and we continue to keep it alive in some way. This is what I mean by, you know, bringing into new interpretations to sustain even more a historical fact that it's particularly important. If we cease to talk about Rwanda, we might have fake news coming up. Sure. Very quickly, right away. That's basically my point. So we actually agree, okay?
Very good indeed. Ram, I don't know if you want to come in on this.
I just want to say that one of the things I think people, whether philosophers or not, we find always difficult, I think, to always tell apart, and perhaps it cannot be, is the difference between a commitment to a notion of what is true, or indeed a notion of what truth ought to consist in or does consist in, and the processes by which we either arrive at it or derive from it certain kinds of evidential and persuasive arguments for its defense. Because when it might depend a lot on what you come, you know, what's the process by which you come to it? So we go back to the question of, say, the postmodern concern looks absolutely justified that you're going to end up with uniform authoritarian modes of existence if you're committed to the truth or the notion of a truth and you worry about it, say, as Popper did. Then we'd say, well, yes, but surely you do actually want more or less everybody in the world to accept the problems of climate change and for all of us really to cohere around a particular set of practices. You don't overfish, or you don't drive long distances, and you don't, you know, you start moving towards sustainable energy sources. Would that be a problem that in fact we have actually a sort of global order derived from the truth? So I think that any overarching theory that moves away from what it is that the truth is that we are aiming for and what it is that we are arguing out of that truth from is forgotten for the sake of a commitment to overarching positions about truth and its possibilities.
Thanks indeed, Ram. What I'd like us to do is to just to think a little bit about how these questions we've been debating might look in the near future and then in the period, perhaps even beyond that. In other words, how can we usefully use this discussion or the premises of the discussion to move forward at a time when I think it's fair to say, if we're talking about, you know, why we're having this in the first place, we're in an era when ideas of objectivity, ideas of facts, ideas of truth are coming under immense assault. And I want to turn back to you, Santiago, if I may, partly because, you know, I know that you have been thinking about the sort of the fake news question in some depth. Is part of the problem that we have so much, we know so much more, we have so much more data these days, that actually it's going to be harder not easier to actually define what is right. Harder to define what is right and true. And in that sense, we have the problem of abundance, so to speak. And in some sense, that's not going to go away, because the only thing I think we can be sure of in the near future is that big data is going to keep getting bigger. To you.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you actually explain why the Democratic Party did not choose Elizabeth Warren to run as vice president, because she wanted to break down the big social network. So that's a problem. We have an amount of information, an amount of data, but I should add of bad information, bad data, because the information we get in The Guardian or in Le Monde, it's very different from even the tweets that come out from Le Monde and The Guardian. So I think that here it's a question again of, why is interpretation, why is it so important to learn to interpret properly? And by properly, I do not mean in the right form, but in such a way that it's productive in some way. Hermeneutic has a very long history, it starts from Aristotle, but also it has a long tradition of biblical hermeneutics and juridical hermeneutics. In other words, we have to learn in some way how to interpret the text. And these texts are interpreted through what? Through other texts, basically. In other words, so I, as a hermeneutic philosopher, for example, let's imagine, I'm not a Catholic, but there's a Catholic country. Would the Bible have survived without an institution like the church? Well, probably not. And so the institution that we do still have, and let's hope they will still stay alive, those are the ones that I think that can help conserve that truth that are some of our traditional texts, but also science maintained, because, and this is my last point, we should also, I am a big fan of Greta Thunberg. I'm sure a lot of people are. But how come that Greta Thunberg managed to attract many more people than so many scientists, like Hansen, for example? Well, it's a question of intensity of the communication she managed to give. Maybe that's one way we can perhaps overcome the problem we have that you lay out on data and bad information.
An intriguing question there, although of course that has to do with also not just the nature of facts, if there are such things, but how they get presented as well. But I want to stick with this question, as I say, moving us in terms of what we might see in the next few years and decades even. Corinne, to this question of whether or not the problem is not lack of data, lack of objective reality as we can measure it and see it and store it up and put it in bar charts, but the fact that we are now in a position where there's so much of it that it can fulfill any interpretation that people of goodwill or ill will want to place upon it.
Just to pick up, I think I understood your question, and I think you're right, and I think Santiago is he's right. Like one problem is that there is so much bad information, and it's just very difficult to tell apart the good information from the bad one, And for me, I guess the key to finding solutions to the predicament we find ourselves in of the fake news and the being overwhelmed by data and all that is trying to sort of go back to our, reflective abilities to provide reasons and to look for reasons for views and we are very much, also in an emotional politics where, I feel like this, so, this is my view and I'm not going to scrutinize it. So, I think rationality and bringing back a focus on providing good reasons is going to be part, and I don't know exactly how we might do that. We might need charismatic people like Greta who actually, makes very good arguments. And I think people listen to actually what her arguments are, not just to the sound bites, as it were. So we might need some charismatic people to emerge or maybe it might be through, education. But it's true that we have to place rationality back into the conversation, because only thinking about this huge amount of data that we're receiving is going to help us sorting out the good from the bad.
Thanks very much indeed, Corinne. Ram, sorry, I was going to bring you in, but let me throw that to you.
For me, all of the contestation about facts, whether we are arguing with certainty about what we believe in, or whether we are arguing towards something that we admit we don't know yet about, what we are missing in today's world is sufficient focus on the political processes by which the sort of the global epistemology of data and debates happens. So it's not so much, for example, Ruth Bader Ginsburg has just died. Now, the point is not so much about whether we are right or wrong in terms of the views that liberal and conservative justices of the American Supreme Court hold. It's rather whether it's right for a president coming up to an election to try and ram through an appointment through the Senate, which belongs to his party. It's that process that we need to pay much more attention to. And of course, it's not that it's not happening, but the Greta Thunbergs of the world mobilize in a particular kind of emotion of ethics, but we still need the global institutions to work. We need to challenge the possibility that global institutions may not work. It's the processes, I think, that we are not paying enough attention to.
Can I press you on that in particular then, Ram? Because I think this is where some of the sort of divergence in our definitions of what's right and what is true become a bit problematic. I mean, we were talking earlier about things, about climate change being, you know, the fact that temperatures are changing across the planet, they are melting ice caps, and you know, all the things that you can prove with a meter or, you know, a thermometer or scientific equipment is the case. In the case of the Supreme Court battle you're talking about and the processes behind that, in the end, those are narratives that are created by societies that call themselves democracies or authoritarian states or whatever else it might be. But surely in that sense, there can't be anything that's right or objectively true. I mean, one of the complaints that authoritarian states have about democracies is that democracies always say that they're right. And one of the things that China has been doing in recent years has been arguing, we're big, we're strong, we're stable, we have a model that isn't democratic, and this is right, not least for us, but maybe for other people as well. But that kind of rightness or truth is not the same as the climate change truth, is it?
Yes. So what I'm trying to say is that this is exactly going back to my very first point, that we cannot simultaneously both be absolutely certain that there are truths and at the same time be baffled as to why there is so little agreement on those truths. How is it that it's possible as humanity in terms of our own evolution, how is it that a very, very small section of the population, say 1% of the population, has a particular truth that because they are highly qualified quantum theorists, they understand, and everybody else thinks isn't the case? It can't be the case that we have evolved as creatures, both capable of intransigence difference and a commitment to truth. So the best thing I would say is to defer the question of whether we are converging on truths at all times in all places, or whether there are no such truths at all, and concentrate on the institutional processes by which that epistemology can be sort of substantiated. It's an extremely open-ended, highly optimistic goal, but hey, we've not been any better thinking we can arrive at the truth. So why not spend a little bit more time thinking about how we might act towards the truth, whether it's there or not?
Okay, Corinne.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm not sure I really see the paradox there, if you wish, because, that has recurred a few times, the conversation, you know, how come we can never arrive, you know, at any kind of consensus around anything, if that is truth out there that just demand to be discovered. I mean, that, as Santiago said at the beginning, there are lots of boring truths we agree on, you know. The more complicated truths are just complicated. And so, having this sort of dichotomy, or this opposition aiming at the truth and not succeeding at finding the truth and, disagreement, I mean, we are making, I mean, many of us take ourselves to making, to, that we're making immense progress. I mean, look at the development of physics, and physics is probably, it's so hard that there's no surprise that it is extremely hard to find answers. I mean, from that perspective, it's no surprise that, we haven't final answers, we don't have final agreement. These questions are probably the big questions. They are the hardest, and we should expect that somehow, a few centuries of thinking about them is going to provide answers, you know. It's good to get us closer, but I don't know.
Sorry, this is my point exactly, because I would then say that in the matter of physics, we have had processes develop relatively recently in human history, which have been more sort of effective, and therefore we are able to substantiate the sense of arriving at truths better than we have with other institutions. Perhaps we will be able to do it in the next couple of centuries with climate change. Perhaps it might be too late, or we might fail to do so. For example, with religious divergences, where we are trying to find different ways of living with multiple truths. So that's my point. I agree. I think we are in agreement. I'm simply saying that what we need at all the times, both with our failures and with our successes, to remember is that the processes, the institutions through which our epistemological processes are pursued, have to be stable enough for us to have a chance of even finding out whether there are truths to converge to or whether they are not.
Well, I'm afraid one thing that I think is objectively and rationally true is that we are coming up to the end of our assigned time here today. Thank you all for joining us.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice, and visit our website, ii.tv, for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.